The company was building bunkers everywhere along the tracks, and it truly came home to Moist that when it came to the railways, the engines and carriages and so forth were just the show up front. The iron horse, which needed to be fueled and watered. And all of this was done by people almost the same colour as the coal, momentarily spotted as you went past and then forgotten. He knew, because he had attended all the meetings and listened, that running a railway was a lot of small puzzles, which, if you opened them, presented you with another sequence, full of constraints, and lists of things that definitely had to be done before anything else could happen. In short, the railway was complexity on wheels. It was amazing that Mr. Simnel's sliding rule didn't glow as red-hot as the furnaces he worked. And in Swinetown, the workshops were turning out more and more engines, little tank engines that trundled up and down the ever-growing compound, shunting trains and carriages together, night trains, slow and heavy, that picked up wagon after wagon from the watercress farmers and others who needed to get their produce to the cities by dawn. The new Flyer Mark II, which had a roof to the footplate and wonderful new green livery, all now with names such as Spirit of Scroat and King of Pseudopolis. Moist suspected that Vetinari had had some say in that coinage, since Pseudopolis had never had a king and was beset by the curse of democracy, an affliction the patrician couldn't abide. The scream of steam was no longer an intrusion, just one of the noises of Ankh-Morpork, like the explosions in the Alchemist's Guild, and, as one old man said to his wife, "You don't need a clock to tell you the time when you know the sound of the 7 o'clock to quirm." It seemed only weeks since Iron Girder had first puffed gently around Harry King's compound, but now, inside a year, branch lines were springing up all across the Stow Plains, connecting little towns and villages in every direction. And near these little towns and villages, spanking new houses for the new railway staff were beginning to appear. Houses with baths and hot running water. Admittedly, the privies were outside, but nevertheless, plumbing was well maintained. Around the Stow Plains, as in other places, it took a while for country people to come to terms with indoor facilities. A privy in the garden with fresh air all around was considered much more hygienic. And if you were careful, the tomatoes you grew would be most excellent. If you don't know what this means, your grandparents will tell you. You could say that for Harry. If something was to be done, then it was to be done properly, and doubly so if Effie was around. On the Quirm line, Harry had had to stop her from giving them a B-day. It was as if there had been a space waiting to be filled. It was steam engine time, and the steam engine had arrived, like a raindrop, dripping precisely into its puddle. And Moist, and Dick, and Harry, and Vetinari, and the rest of them were simply splashes in the storm. Then one day, at the Ankh-Morpork terminus, as Moist was setting out yet again to the Stow Plains, a lady got into his carriage, introduced herself as Mrs. Georgina Bradshaw, and sat down, gripping her expensive-looking bag with both hands. When Moist got up to offer her his forward-facing seat, as railway etiquette apparently demanded, she said, "Oh, my dear sir, don't worry about me, but thank you. I know a gentleman when I see one." "Moist von Lipwig, at your service, ma'am." "Oh, are you the Mr. Lipwig? Mr. Lipwig the railway man? I've heard all about you." "Yes, I am, I suppose," said Moist, "when no other contender is available." "Isn't this fascinating?" continued Mrs. Bradshaw. "I've never been on a train before. I've taken the precaution of bringing some pills in case I feel nauseous. Has that ever happened to you?" "No, madam, I quite like the rhythm of the railway," said Moist. "But tell me, where did you get those precious pills?" "It was a gentleman called Professor Dibbler, a purveyor of nostrums against the railway illnesses. He was quite persuasive." Moist couldn't help his smile and said, "I imagine he was, madam. Mr. Dibbler is at best nothing more than a charming scamp, I'm afraid, and I'm quite certain his nostrums will be nothing more than expensive sugar and miscellaneous substances. I fear he's in the vanguard of the peddlers of patent medications, which tax my patience." She laughed. "Well put, sir. I'll consider that tuppence halfpenny down the drain. So, may I ask, what is your business on the railway?" "None, really. I thought, well, you only live once. And when I was a little girl, my mother said I was always following carts to see where they were going. and now that my husband Archibald has passed on, I thought that this should be the time to go and see the world. You know, faraway places with strange-sounding names, like Two Shirts and Effing Forest and Scroat. One imagines all manner of exotic occurrences must take place somewhere with a name like Two Shirts. So many places I've never been to. I have a whole world to experience before it's too late, and I'm keeping a journal of it all as I go, so I'll be able to enjoy the world all over again when I get back. Something struck in Moist's head, causing him to say, "May I ask, Mrs. Bradshaw, if your handwriting is good?" She looked down her nose at him and said, "Indeed, yes, Mr. Lipvig. I used to write a beautiful cursive script for my dear late husband. He was a lawyer, and they expect excellence in the writing and use of the language. Mr. Slant was always very particular about that, and no one appreciates the judicious use of lattation better than dear Archibald did. And, may I add, I was schooled at the Quern College for Young Ladies, where they are very solid on the teaching of foreign tongues, even though more Porkian rather seems to have become the lingua quirma of late." Mrs. Bradshaw sniffed. "And in working for my husband, I learned a lot about people and the human condition." "Mrs. Bradshaw, if you were to go everywhere where the trains go and write about all those places, perhaps you could send me a copy of your notes. They could be useful to other intrepid passengers. People would know what to expect from the Effing Forest or Two Shirts before they'd even paid a penny for their ticket. Already so many people from Ank are travelling to Quirm just for the sunshine. It's become our heaviest service, and some of them go just for the day. I'm sure they'd think about going on other trips too if they saw all the little details of every place you visit. And perhaps you could include notes on accommodation as well as other places of interest en route," he added, on fire with his own imagination. "All the things that you would like to see and would be interested in. Wherever your travels take you, you can address your manuscript to Moist von Lipvig and give it to the nearest stationmaster, and they'll see to it that it gets passed on to me." Moist thought about the amount of gold accruing in the coffers of Harry King's accounts and added, "And I'm sure we could arrange some remuneration." As Mrs. Bradshaw settled into the journey and looked out the window, Moist took out his notebook and scribbled a memo to Harry King. "Please allow Mrs. Georgina Bradshaw to travel anywhere she wants, even those little branch lines we haven't fully opened yet. She went to one of the best girls' schools I know of and understands language, and she is writing notes on all our destinations, which may come in very useful. My instincts say that she will do us proud. I have an inkling that she will be either meticulous or humorous, or hopefully both. And a widow who wears the kind of gold and diamond ring that she is wearing to travel through Ankh-Morpork and is still wearing it when she leaves is not going to be a fool. She speaks as well as Lady Sybil. That's Quirm College for you. Up school. Isn't this what we're after? We want people to widen their horizons on the train, of course, but why not day trips? You know what? There are people in Ankh-Morpork who haven't even got as far as Stow Lat yet. Travel broadens the mind, and also railway revenue." A sample of the great work arrived on scented paper 1 week later. "High Moulderings on the Stow Plains boasts wonderful saltwater baths from a pleasantly warm spring, and the owner and his wife give hygienic massages to those who would like to enjoy the benefit. Ladies and gentlemen separately, of course. There is nothing here that could be considered insalubrious or that would shock the most delicate of sensibilities. Nearby, the Hotel Continental offers accommodation for trolls, humans, dwarfs and goblins. 50 rooms are available at present. People wishing to tour the area may be interested in the sacred glade of Shock Knee, which deserves to be noticed for its amazing echoes. A short distance away is a shrine to Annoia, patron goddess for people who have difficulty with things stuck in their drawers. A welcome break for the tired at weekends with excellent meals. Highly recommended." Moist made a note to see Mr. Thomas Goatberger when he could next get back to Ankh-Morpork. If he was any judge, the publisher would be ready to bite his hand off to get a share of the railway magic. When Moist did next return to the city, the matter of the railway to Ubervalt had to take priority. pacing up and down in the big room where Harry and Dick Simnel presided over their charts and reports and blueprints, Harry was still clearly worried. "Now then, Moist, between ourselves and these four walls, I've got the EBGBs. We've taken gangs off the other lines, we're putting in more and more work on the long haul to Uberwald. This is an hell of an undertaking. I'm more at home knee-deep in shit, which is what we're going to be in here, in this office, if this doesn't work, believe you me."
"Yes," said Moist, "but what you have to remember is that getting to Uberwald will mean getting to a whole load of other places on the way, and all of them will want the railway, and that'll help cover the costs right there. It's the tunnels and bridges that are a problem, but the best of it is that they're old technologies. There are plenty of masons who can build good bridges for us, and as for tunnels, the trolls are just begging to do them if they can dig out a home nearby."
Harry's only response was a grunt.
"And the nice thing about the trolls," Moist added, "is that they bring the whole family with them, even their kids. It's their way. If you don't know your rocks, you're no good as a troll. They just love changing the landscape. One of them asked me the other day if he could be a surveyor, and I was just opening my mouth to say no when I thought, why not? He seemed like a bright lad. Slow, yes, but quite bright. So I've told the boys to give him a bit of tuition, on the job, as it were."
"Are you going to give him one of Simnel's special sliding slabs?" said Harry, smiling. Moist laughed and said, "Why not, Harry? I might just do that. No reason why a surveyor shouldn't be strong enough to lift up a mountain to see what's underneath." He took advantage of the lightened atmosphere to steer Sir Harry towards happier subjects, asking to be brought up to date on all the latest developments. Every morning now, the desk of Harry King was inundated by letters from people wanting no trains, some trains, or seriously wishing to have trains available right now. And then there were all the other helpful comments and suggestions. Mr. Snorri Snorrison had written to say so many other people had arranged to meet under the station clock that his friend had taken 4 hours to find him. Shouldn't the railway provide stepladders for the use of shorter citizens? Help was requested for passengers with heavy luggage and for the elderly or undead. With all the dangerous machinery involved, shouldn't there be guards? Not the city watch, of course, but somebody with some sense to act as a guardian of the train and its passengers. And that meant uniforms, hats, flags, whistles, and other exciting accoutrements. And this excitement was presumably why the editor of the Ankh-Morpork Times had decided to employ a railway correspondent, Mr. Raymond Shuttle, who was an unashamed and self-confessed train spotter. The glint in his eyes was unmistakable. Alongside the main business of the railway, Harry confessed himself delighted to see the enthusiasts spending their dollars on railway souvenirs, such as the little clockwork models that were even now being created under licence by those deviously cunning artificers who were making a small fortune from railway memorabilia. This would have been an even bigger fortune had not Thunderbolt carefully made certain that the Hygienic Railway Company took its slice. And the cannier artificers, always on the lookout for money-making opportunities, were constantly making additions to these playthings for children. A little shed and 4 tiny figures to wait for the train. A signal box with a waving goblin. And yes, a miniature turning table, just like the one in the compound. And so it went on. A lad with a doting parent could get his own tiny iron girder and oval track with straights and curves. And even miniature railway workers, including a miniature Harry King. Harry was thrilled. He tried to be nonchalant about it, but when he heard the suggestion that he should be part of a toy railroad, he grinned from ear to ear, although Effie complained that they had made him look too fat. And once again, Moist marvelled at the power of the dream. And then it was out into the grease-filled world of the compound to see the latest engines the lads were testing, and find out what the ingenious Mr. Simnel had been up to since Moist had seen him last. One thing he was sure of, even though Dick Simnel was forever coming up with blueprints for the next locomotive, every day would have seen him still hard at work on Iron Girder, which was probably why on every visit she continued to look a little different. A different boiler here, different wheels there, different paintwork, and quite probably a host of integral things that Moist couldn't see. She was Dick's pride and joy, his first locomotive love, thought Moist, taking care not to say it aloud, the first test bed for every new innovation. No locomotive shone as brightly as Iron Girder,
No locomotive got the next big improvement before Iron Gerda. She was indeed the iron stalking horse for the railway, and Simnel her willing slave. Just as Moist was debating where first to look for Simnel, Emily King, in a very fine white cotton dress, came jauntily skipping through the compound towards the sacred engine shed, as if completely unaware of the attendant muck and grease. But after all, he thought, she must have grown up with her uncle's other business, against which the railway was a fragrant pleasure garden. And here she was, bouncing along cheerfully, and here was Iron Gerda, and suddenly Moist's spine went cold, every sinew twanging, and he was near to biting his nails as the girl continued towards the locomotive in her pristine white cotton dress. Moist moved like lightning across the compound as Emily skipped on and reached Iron Gerda. He looked at Simnel, whose face had gone curiously grey, even under the grease and grime, and he was ready for anything as Emily patted the engine and said, "Hello, Iron Gerda, how are we today, you lovely girl?" And while Moist was still gawping, Emily took out her handkerchief and buffed Iron Gerda's brass nameplate industriously until it sparkled to the heavens. And as Emily was talking to Iron Gerda about how good she was looking today, Simnel turned to Moist and said, very, very quietly, "She wouldn't have, you know, not Iron Gerda." "Good," said Moist. "And now you have two ladies, you lucky man." But in his head a voice said to him, "But you more than half expected it, didn't you, Mr. Lipwig, O ye of little faith?" And then there was a sigh of steam. For the next 2 hours, Moist sat at his desk in Harry's compound, feeling as if he were a locomotive speeding along, watching the scenery blur past. Every so often, a boy came up with another pile of paperwork from some part of Harry King's domain, and towards the end of the afternoon, he felt himself subtly drifting into a coma, quite a pleasant one at the start. He visualised himself in a pale pink mist, and it didn't matter. Nothing mattered. And little by little, Moist von Lipwig began to unravel. But just as he was sliding under, of the twilight the darkness dropped down in front of him, out of the evening glow, though exactly where it dropped from, Moist couldn't work out. "Must get to sleep, Mr. Lipwig. Burning candle at both ends means a man with egg on face and burning bum. When did Mr. Lipwig last eat? Not snack, serious munch. I have some dried mushrooms if you are feeling peckish. No? Acquired taste. More for me. But you must sleep if nothing else. Mr. Lipwig can't do everything. If he can't eat, can't do anything. Making money is good, but there is no pockets in a shroud. Give it a rest, Mr. Railway, and this will help you big time, no mistake." The goblin handed Moist a little bottle on which a grubby label proclaimed the contents as rat poison. "Label one big lie, Mr. Lipwig. Bottle cleaned out and rats eaten, yes indeed, and filled with special goblin potion for tired person. Guaranteed no worms, and it will give you refreshing sleep, and you will feel a lot better if you wake up in the morning. Guaranteed. Pure quill, none finer." It had been a long day, and the heat of the smelters had made him as dry as the smelters themselves. And so, what the hell? Moist took a long swig. "Well done, Mr. Lipwig," chuckled the goblin. "It will make your hairs curl. Everywhere." Later, after Moist had finished talking to the dancing toadstools and Mr. Whoopee, the man who could amusingly eat his own face, it must have been Moist's feet alone that found his bed, plodding along like a couple of old donkeys via the good offices of Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobby Nobbs, who apparently found him just outside his house, talking to his knees. And, according to Nobby, listening intently to what they had to say. He awoke, lying on his bedroom floor. Somebody had put blankets over him and even tucked him up nicely. He grasped his head and thought, "Oh no, I drank another goblin concoction." His dismay dwindled when he realised that he felt absolutely fine, and not just fine either, but so full of beans that the world probably had no beans left. When he stepped outside onto the balcony for a breath of fresh air, the birds were singing and the sky was a wonderful shade of blue. The door opened behind him, and a doorbell said, "I know we have what might be called an unconventional marriage, what with our jobs and the pressure of work and so on, but I wouldn't be doing my wifely duty if I didn't ask you whether you have been firky-doodling with fast and loose women. No pressure. Answer in your own time." More or less spinning with the ecstasy of being alive, and of course all those beans, Moist said joyfully, Now then, just a minute. Bear with me now. Tell me, is it loose women or is it fast women? Is there a spotter's guide or does one, as it were, cancel out the other? Moist von Lipwig, you are rascally drunk. Can you even walk? For an answer, Moist jumped in the air, clicking his heels, and said, Fast or loose, my girl, or why not both at once? Dragging him back into their bedroom and closing the door behind them, Adora Bell said, Well now, husband of mine, in that case let's find out. There was a thunderstorm over Schmalzberg, but that was ever the case. Thunder rolled around the mountains like the marbles of the gods. And in the privacy of his office, the Low King was discussing progress with Aaron, who was looking more cheerful than usual. Things appear to be calming down, Rhys said. They argue, and then somebody remembers that he has business to deal with concerning his rat farms, or there's some trouble over in his gold mine. Water coming in, pit props buckling and so on and so forth. Things they can't leave to underlings, and then everything goes quiet. I know you're worried, said Aaron, but I think, no, I believe, that you have more friends than you ever thought possible. Even the goblins know that you were one of the first who signed up for the goblin emancipation. They, whether we like it or not, are becoming the future, Rhys. It was the business with the Klax Towers that made even traditional dwarfs angry. The Klax is needed. Everybody wants news. People are furious everywhere. After all, they say, goblins and trolls are minding their own business, so why not the dwarfs? No more news of Ardent, asked the king. It's been months, hasn't it? No more towers down or idiots trying to destroy the railway. Can I believe that his firebrand has burned out? Aaron handed the king his coffee and said, I believe Lord Vetinari said never do anything until you hear the screams. However, Ardent is not one to come back, helmet in hand, to say sorry. There is too much pride there by half. After a quiet moment, while Rhys Reeson considered the possibilities, Aaron continued. So we will accept the invitation to the summit in Quirm? In these circumstances, Rhys, it does seem to me that it is very important that you are there and seen to be there. Of course, Diamond King will be chairing proceedings this year, and I must mend fences. He's helpful, but I'm in no mood to try his patience. He has always been a most understanding ally. And the other thing? The other thing is satisfactory, said the king. He paused. Yes, we should go to Quirm, but I think it would be wise to leave Albrechtsen in charge here, just to take care of any business. Without his quite knowing how it had come about, and regardless of how little he was actually at the compound, it appeared that Moist was now Mr. Railway. If anyone wanted to know anything about it, they asked him. If they'd lost their little child in the queue for Iron Girder, the call went out for Mr. Lipwig, and if somebody had a new idea for the railway, it was sent to Mr. Lipwig. And after a while, it didn't seem to Moist to matter what time it was, or worse, where he was. The claims on his attention were never-ending. He was pretty certain that he slept quite often, sometimes back at home, if at all possible, or saving that a mattress and blanket somewhere within the warm and ever-enlarging foundries along the route to Uberwald, or, if all else failed, snuggled down under the tarpaulins of whatever railway gang was nearby, having shared whatever was in the cooking pot. If you were lucky, it was pheasant or possibly grouse. And if you weren't so lucky, at least there would be pot luck, which generally meant cabbages and swedes and almost certainly something that was protein, but you wouldn't want to see what it was in daylight. However, to give them their due, the railway gangs, including the vanguard now bearing down on Slake, were resourceful men, especially in the tradition of setting snares to fill their pots along the permanent way. Slake was one of those places, Moist thought, that you put on the map because it was embarrassing to have a map with holes in it. There was some mining, forestry and fishing, and after a while you got the feeling that those people who chose to live in Slake and the surrounding area were people who didn't want other people to know where they were. And when you walked around Slake, you were always certain that you were being watched. He put it down as a place to avoid unless you liked bad cooking and banjos. Nevertheless, it had a mare and was nailed to the map as a coaling and water stop. No longer did Moist wear the snazzy suits and handmade shoes that, along with his collection of official-looking hats, were his calling card back in the city. They didn't stand up well to the regime of the railway worker, and so now he wore the greasy shirt and waistcoat with rough trousers tied at the knee. He loved the huge boots and the flat cap that seemed to go with them, making you feel safe at both ends. But the boots, oh, the boots. A troll could drop on your head and you'd be dead, but the boots would still be alive and kicking. They had hobnails and were more or less like tiny fortresses. Nothing could get past a railway worker's boots. Messages found Moist wherever he might be, via train, goblin runner or clax, since there were very few places these days where their towers hadn't found a niche in the landscape. In the small hours of one morning, in the plains township of Little Swelling, when it was pouring with rain that hammered on the makeshift lodgings, Moist pulled back the tarpaulin and wood door to see the face of the Twilight the Darkness, who couldn't be called soaked because there was really very little of him to soak. With all goblins, the male ones especially, you got the impression of sinews, but they mostly consisted of sinews tied together with other sinews. Surely, the mind protested, there must be muscles in there somewhere, but quite possibly they had to fight to find some room among all those damn sinews. As soon as the goblin got inside the bothy, such water as was on him simply disappeared. Almost automatically, Moist looked up to see the lights of the local clax tower, and as he did so, it flashed a familiar code. It was from Adora Bell. He recognised her code as easily as he would recognise his own. "Quickly," he said, "get up that tower and get that message back to me now." He waited, and in the gloom, the voice of the Twilight the Darkness said, "Did I hear the magic word, Mr. Little Damp?" Moist was surprised at himself, because even though the goblin had a smell you could almost see, that was no reason for not minding your manners. So he said, "Please, Mr. of the Twilight the Darkness, thank you so very much." And thus chastened, Moist kept silent as the little goblin scuttled back out into the rain and scampered towards the tower. Moist finished his ablutions, gathered his things together, on the assumption that, whatever the message, it would require him to go somewhere else, and went out to where the golem horse was waiting unregarding of the weather, just in case it needed waking up, because however hard he tried, he couldn't think of it as anything other than alive. Admittedly, the horse was giving him incipient piles, no matter how much padding he put between himself and it. And although the creature could now speak, Moist still yearned for all those fussing little rituals that defined horsemanship. He was aware that there should be such things as nosebags and adjusting the straps and giving the beast some water. The lack of these rituals slightly unbalanced Moist. It was creepy. In the falling rain, it was as if he was in two different worlds. And while he was wondering whether he should give the horse a name, which somehow would have made things feel better, Mr. of the Twilight the Darkness arrived, clutching a damp and smudged pink clax flimsy. "Veterinary wants to see you immediately. Stop. P.S. Any chance of bringing home some of that goblin potion with you? Stop. P.P.S. If you pass a bakery, we could do with a couple of sliced loaves. Stop. Your loving wife. Stop." And he thought, well, isn't it nice to be wanted?